And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Friday, April 19th. For the Virginia Voice, your readers are Harriet Coulter and Dave Winter.
And we'll start this segment on the opinions page, page A11, with Virginia needs to close gaps to protect victims, disarming domestic abusers. This opinion piece is written by Kelly Roskam. With the conclusion of Virginia's veto session, Governor Glenn Youngkin refused to do more to protect individuals, most of whom are women, experiencing domestic violence. Violence against partners and family members is a public health epidemic. The danger is amplified for victims of domestic violence when combined with the prevalence and accessibility of firearms. To protect victims, survivors, and the public, domestic abusers are often prohibited from possessing firearms, yet enforcement of those prohibitions are lacking. By vetoing bills aimed at strengthening our domestic violence and firearms laws, Governor Youngkin chose to protect abusers and their firearms rather than victims and public health. Domestic violence and firearms are pervasive problems. According to one study, approximately 1 million U.S. women alive today have had firearms used against them by intimate partners, and about 4.5 million U.S. women have had intimate partners threaten them with firearms. The danger goes beyond injury and threats. Another study found that a woman who is domestically abused is 5 times more likely to be killed by a male partner when there is a firearm in the house. In 2020 alone, 70% of domestic violence-related homicides in Virginia were by firearm. We also know that laws addressing the intersection of domestic violence and firearms are effective at significantly reducing intimate partner homicide. In the last decade, the Commonwealth has made significant progress toward addressing the deadly combination of domestic violence and firearms. Virginia has prohibited possession of firearms and required the surrender of firearms by persons subject to final protective orders. The state also prohibited the purchase, possession, and transportation of firearms by persons convicted of misdemeanor assault and battery of a family or household member. But more must be done to fully realize the promise of these protections. Several bills passed by the General Assembly that were vetoed by Governor Youngkin would have closed significant gaps. Senate Bill 47 and House Bill 46 would have mandated that when someone had to relinquish their firearms, those guns would have to go to someone 21 or older who does not live with the person subject to the order. As of now, someone can relinquish their weapons to another person living in the same home, which means firearms may still be immediately accessible to dangerous people. The new bill also would have required the person subject to the order to provide the name and address of the person to whom they surrendered firearms to court, allowing law enforcement to check that firearms were actually surrendered. Finally, they would have extended the requirement to surrender firearms to include persons convicted of misdemeanor crimes of assault and battery of family or household members. Two other bills, Senate Bill 642 and House Bill 362, would have also ensured anyone convicted of assault and battery against current or former dating partners are not allowed to possess a firearm for 3 years. The current law only pertains to persons convicted of assault and battery of family or household members. When Governor Youngkin vetoed these bills, he allowed dangerous individuals, like those subject to family abuse protective orders or with convictions of assault and battery of a family or household member, the opportunity to still possess firearms. Governor Youngkin's veto message, which described the legislation as failing to achieve its intended purpose, and unnecessary, reflects a fatal misunderstanding of the nature of domestic and intimate partner violence, as well as the existing legal framework to address it. Domestic violence perpetrated with firearms continues to be a pervasive public health crisis in Virginia and across the nation. There is an abundance of public health research that illustrates just how dangerous domestic abusers are, specifically those with access to guns, to not only victims and survivors, but also to public safety at large. Governor Youngkin can and should defend Virginians from domestic violence by firearms and ensure the disarmament of dangerous abusers throughout the state. He chose not to. Again, Virginia needs to close gaps to protect victims. Written by Kelly Roskam, who is Director of Law and Policy at the Center for Gun Violence Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
And we'll continue now on the opinions page with another essay. This one has the headline, Academic Freedom, Attacks on DEI Reveal Harsh Truth. The authors are Jeremy C. Young, the Freedom to Learn Program Director at Penn America, and Sam LaFrance, the Editorial Manager for Free Expression and Education at Penn America. Opponents of diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education argue that dismantling DEI offices and initiatives on campus won't negatively impact the academic freedom of faculty to teach relevant subject matter in their classes. So how do they explain what happened recently in Virginia? Early this semester, in an apparent effort to thwart new diversity requirements in general education curricula, at Virginia Commonwealth University and George Mason University, Governor Glenn Youngkin's administration requested and received syllabi for 27 courses. The courses, which had already been approved by faculty and some which had already been taught, included everything from race and racism in the United States to modern architecture and peoples and cultures of India. But the governor's syllabi requests of these two public universities have placed the future of the courses and the general education requirements in question. It's important to recognize how unique and alarming the governor's action is. Despite an escalating campaign of educational gag orders and DEI bans being adopted in state legislatures, this is the first instance in recent memory in which a state Department of Education, acting entirely on its own and with no supporting law on the books, has targeted curricular requirements or syllabi of individual faculty for their content or viewpoint. This action comes after Youngkin's recent claims to be extremely worried about the state of free speech on campus and assertions that colleges should challenge beliefs and foster informed debate. His Secretary of Education, Amy Rogstad Gadira, similarly expressed a desire to build a culture of freedom and open discourse on campus because free speech and open inquiry are non-negotiable. Even so, the governor's spokesman justified the syllabi request by describing the 27 courses not as examples of faculty members engaging in open inquiry, but as a thinly veiled attempt to incorporate the progressive left's groupthink on Virginia's students. Apparently, the governor only supports challenging the beliefs of those with whom he disagrees. Beyond Virginia, perhaps the most significant impact of the Youngkin administration's recent actions is what it proves about the government attacks on DEI initiatives within universities. In the end, they inevitably impact the academic freedom of faculty. The argument that DEI can be banned by statute without impacting faculty speech is common among DEI opponents. Former Heritage Foundation visiting fellow and vocal DEI opponent Adam Kissel, for instance, has insisted that state governments should not interfere with the academic freedom to have robust discussions in class, but instead assert its prerogative over the content of the curriculum. Manhattan Institute senior fellow and New College of Florida trustee Christopher Rufo has opposed restrictions on classroom speech, but has argued that DEI offices should be abolished and that government should use political power to shape their initiatives and curricula. As the Virginia case demonstrates, the flaw in this line of thinking is that undermining universities' independence from the ideological dictates of politicians inevitably leads to restrictions on the classroom. The trickle-down effect on campus speech has already become clear in Texas, which banned DEI offices and initiatives last year. A visiting speaker who had planned to give a talk at the University of Texas in Austin about how to find a mentor on campus was told that her speech violated the law because it included anecdotes about her own experiences as an LGBTQ plus student. Even after she changed the content of her speech, her talk was canceled. And faculty at Texas public universities have reported being forced to change course titles, remove any DEI language from our website, and reframe any committees or initiatives focused on these issues. The Youngkin administration, however, has gone even further by transforming an attack on DEI into an attack on faculty. By targeting specific faculty syllabi, the governor has engaged, as VCU's faculty union put it, in an unprecedented overreach and a form of attack on academic freedom and the First Amendment right to free speech on our college campuses. The faculty are right. In his zeal to fight groupthink on campus, the governor has imposed his own version of groupthink at Virginia colleges, and in doing so, he has ripped off the mask of attacks on DEI and revealed the truth. Faculty speech and academic freedom have been in danger all along. And that essay had the headline, Attacks on DEI Reveal Harsh Truth. And its authors were Jeremy C. Young, the Freedom to Learn Program Director at Penn America, and Sam LaFrance, the Editorial Manager for Free Expression and Education at Penn America.
And our final essay from the opinions page is titled, Assertive Diplomacy, Iran Remains a Threat to Peace, written by the editors of Bloomberg Opinion. Though largely thwarted by Israel and its allies, the assault launched by Iran against the Jewish state last weekend was a powerful reminder that the Tehran regime remains the biggest threat to peace in the Middle East. Israel's security would be best served now through resolve and restraint rather than military escalation. Iranian leaders tried to portray Saturday's attack as a proportional response to a presumed Israeli strike that killed a top Iranian commander and several advisors in Damascus, Syria, on April 1. The operation involved more than 300 drones and cruise and ballistic missiles, with Iran attacking Israel from its own territory for the first time. The assault dramatically increased the risk of a region-wide war, even if Iran hoped the matter was now concluded. In military terms, Iran's attack was a failure. Israeli and U.S. forces, with help from the U.K., France, Jordan, and possibly some of Israel's other Arab neighbors, shot down an estimated 99% of the incoming missiles and drones, most of them before they reached Israeli airspace. Rather than reinforcing Israel's isolation, the attack illustrated how strong its alliances remain despite anger over its conduct of the war against Hamas in Gaza. President Joe Biden rightly vowed ironclad support for Israel's defense, even as he pressures Israeli leaders to ease conditions for Gazans. Like any state, Israel reserves the right to respond to a direct assault on its territory. But a tit-for-tat strike on Iran would cast Israel once again as the aggressor, jeopardizing the support of Europe and even the U.S. Meanwhile, the war in Gaza is far from finished, with top Hamas leaders still free and more than 100 Israeli hostages still in captivity. The border with Lebanon remains unsettled, preventing thousands of Israelis from returning to their homes in the north. After months of fighting, Israel's military is stretched. The obvious strength of Israel's defenses should serve as some deterrent against future Iranian attacks. Covert action by Israel has had success degrading Iran's nuclear program and its network of militant proxies and could be used again. Most important, restraint would allow Israel and its supporters to capitalize on the moment, not least by reminding Arab neighbors where their true interests lie. The failed strikes underscore the danger Iran poses to them as well as to Israel. Iran's nuclear advances, it can now assemble enough fissile material for several bombs within weeks, threaten a regional arms race. Its proxies have attacked the Saudi and Gulf monarchies in the past. The detente they have struck with Tehran is unlikely to last. In foiling the weekend attack, the U.S. and Israel have demonstrated to Arab leaders just how useful they can be as partners. The Biden administration should seize this opportunity to further isolate Iran within the region and beyond. The U.S. should work with its G7 partners to refocus global attention on Iran's destructive behavior, including its continued support for militant groups like Hamas, its supply of drones and missiles to Russia for use against Ukraine, and its continued stonewalling of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Simultaneously, U.S. officials should press ahead with efforts to revive a deal to normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which could open the door to a broader and more unified coalition to contain Iran. Israel's long-term security requires peaceful relations with its neighbors, including the Palestinians, coupled with containment of Iran and its proxies. Rigorous and assertive diplomacy is needed to accomplish those objectives and prevent a wider war. Again, from the editors of Bloomberg Opinion, Iran remains a threat to peace.
And we have no letters to the editor today, so we will continue now with a news on page A4 with an article that has the headline, Ed Official Tapped for Cannabis Control Authority. This article by Anna Bryson of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. A senior-level Virginia Department of Education official has left her post to serve as Governor Glenn Youngkin's special advisor to the CEO of the Virginia Cannabis Control Authority. Although she has no experience with cannabis policy, the Youngkin administration says Elizabeth Schultz is uniquely positioned to serve under the Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security, Terrence Cole. On Thursday, Youngkin Press Secretary Christian Martinez said in a statement, Elizabeth Schultz's extensive background in education makes her uniquely positioned to play a pivotal role in informing and educating Virginians about the dangers of cannabis, specifically our youth. Her experience in developing educational programs will be beneficial to efficiently communicate the potential risks and safety concerns associated with cannabis use. Also on Thursday, the Youngkin administration announced that M. Cooper has been named as the new Deputy Superintendent of Teaching and Learning. Cooper most recently served as Deputy Assistant Superintendent of Educator Development for the Louisiana Department of Education, which has more than 170 school systems. Cooper succeeds Marcy Sorensen, who was named Acting Superintendent of the La Joya Independent School District in La Joya, Texas. The Cannabis Control Authority is the principal source of Virginia government expertise on cannabis. Formed in 2021 by the Virginia Legislature, the CCA has broad authority to develop, issue, and enforce rules about the existing medical cannabis market and a prospective adult-use retail market. Youngkin has consistently said he is not interested in setting up a retail market for cannabis. In one of his record 153 vetoes this year, he rejected legislation that would have allowed the recreational retail sales of marijuana to begin next year, a Democratic priority. The proposed legislation of retail marijuana in the Commonwealth endangers Virginians' health and safety, Youngkin said in a March 28 statement announcing the veto. Schultz's last day as the State Education Department's Assistant State Superintendent of Public Instruction was April 9th. She started at the agency in January 2022 under then-State Superintendent Jillian Ballow. Schultz is the 12th top-level official to leave the Virginia Department of Education since State Superintendent Lisa Coons became the agency's leader in April 2023. Over the past 2 years, two assistant superintendents and two deputy superintendents have left the Virginia Department of Education, along with nine directors who act as heads of departments within the agency. We've had a number of great leaders who made the decision to retire after giving many decades of service to the Commonwealth students, said Todd Reed, a spokesman for the Department of Education. We're proud to continue the very important work they've done and are thankful for the time and talents they have given. In a farewell email to her colleagues, Schultz wrote, I wish Dr. Coons the best in her continuing leadership of the agency and pray for the blessings of success in your work, along with personal and professional well-being for each of you. Schultz previously worked for the U.S. Department of Education under the Trump administration and served as a Fairfax County school board member. As a school board member, Schultz opposed including gender identity and sexual orientation in the district's non-discrimination policies and resisted the decision to rename a high school named for a Confederate general. In 2021, she worked as a senior fellow at the Parents Defending Education, a conservative nonprofit that says it works to reclaim schools from activists who impose ideologically driven curriculum that emphasizes race, sexual orientation, and gender. The Cannabis Control Authority is included in the state budget under the executive branch, but the legislature's Democrat-led budget committees, vexed by what they consider political interference by the Youngkin administration in management of critical state government operations, proposed to make the CCA a state agency that is fully independent under the budget. And that article had the headline, Ed Official Tapped for Cannabis Control Authority, and it was written by Anna Bryson of the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
We'll turn to page A10, where Sean Sublett, the chief meteorologist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, says cooler spells ahead, but no signs of frost. Overall, there are not many big weather hazards ahead in Virginia. There are a few chances for rain in the next 10 days, but none looks like huge soakers. Temperatures will fluctuate a bit on either side of normal for the rest of the month, but there is no sign of a massive heat wave nor a late season freeze. In the shorter term, a weak cold front pushes across Virginia on Friday, spawning a few showers and perhaps a thunderstorm, but these will not be well organized, and most locations that do manage to get some rain will probably have less than a tenth of an inch. In its wake, the weekend looks largely dry across Virginia. Late Sunday afternoon, a disturbance will come together in eastern North Carolina, and it may send some rain northwestward back into Virginia late Sunday afternoon or Sunday night. But the best chances for rain will be within a dozen or so miles of the North Carolina state line and generally east of Bugs Island Lake. Afternoon temperatures this weekend and early next week will average in the 60s to lower 70s, with nights in the 40s. A few nights near and west of the Blue Ridge will edge into the upper 30s early next week, which could lead to some patchy frost, but there is no indication of a legitimate push of late-season Arctic air into the state. As a result, the last several days of the month are expected to be near or slightly warmer than normal. Normal highs are in the lower to middle 70s. Normal lows are in the upper 40s to around 50. Getting into May, there are no strong, consistent signals regarding temperature or precipitation patterns for Virginia. There are small signals pointing in opposite directions, both cooler and warmer than normal, suggesting that there is more noise than signal in the longer-range data right now. With that in mind, it is probably safe to start the growing season in most of Virginia east of the Appalachians. In Richmond, the latest in the season, reaching the 20s, was in 1956, when it dipped to 28 degrees on the morning of April 21. Getting into May, the record low for the month is 31, also set in 1956, on the morning of May 9. Cooler spells have happened as recently as 2020, when it dipped to 32 on May 10, but that is far from a hard freeze. Even though Memorial Day remains several weeks away, another milestone comes on May 5 when solar summer begins. This is the quarter of the year when the sun is highest in the sky. Continuing until August 4, it is the time of the year when sunburn can happen most quickly. The summer solstice, marking the start of astronomical summer, happens roughly at the midpoint of solar summer, and this is the day when the sun gets highest in the sky at noon. This year, the solstice occurs on June 20, when the sun reaches 76 degrees above the horizon at noon. This all means flip-flop season is just around the corner. Again from Sean Sublett, cooler spells ahead, but no signs of frost.
And now we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back with today's obituaries and more news.